All right, here we go. It's Monday. That's the scramble. No Kyone Wolf today. She's taking a few days off, although you will hear her on tomorrow's show. Tomorrow's show is all about dinosaurs. It's from the Peabody Museum in New Haven, where there will be dinosaurs watching us as we speak. But that's tomorrow. Today we're doing the scramble, which means we're going to run through a bunch of topics that kind of popped up over the weekend for us. Right now, what we're going to do is talk to Lowell Weicker, former U.S. Senator, former governor of Connecticut, and currently somebody who spends a fair amount of his time wondering what happened to the American political system that he used to participate in, and very specifically what happened to his old home party, the Republican Party, where he spent most of his political life. He wrote about that for The Current over the weekend, and we're going to talk to him about that now. Governor, welcome back to our airwaves.
Good to talk to you.
So when you write about this and you say that in some ways you feel as though the moment at which Donald Trump is consecrated in Cleveland as the nominee of the Republican Party will represent the culmination of something, what do you think it's the culmination of?
Well, it certainly is the culmination, or the God of Dameron, of the Republican Party as we know it. That process has been going on, oh, certainly for the last two decades, and now it reaches its final end in this ridiculous scenario of an entertainer being the candidate for president of the United States in one of the major parties. It's the old scenario, as far as I'm concerned, of Walt Kelly, the famous cartoonist, we have met the enemy and he is us, mm-hmm. in the sense that we've gotten to this point because nobody in America is participating in the process. Or at least, let's put it this way, right now I think we're at about 52% for presidential elections. So a majority is what, 23.6, somewhere around there. And within that narrow percentage, it's possible for any nutcase to become, or incompetent person to become, president of the United States, and that's where we are now with Trump, and to a lesser extent with Clinton and Sanders.
Well, let's talk about Trump and the Republicans a little bit more for a second, and let me ask you a question and then tell you what I mean by it. I guess my question is, does Trump represent the fruition, the culmination of this process of ideological purification, or does he reject the rejection of it? I mean, in a way, if you looked at, say, Paul Ryan is probably the embodiment of American, you know, pretty far-right conservatism. He's not in the Freedom Caucus. He's not a Tea Party guy, but he sort of, you know, stands for a lot of those things. So when Paul Ryan tries to go to sleep at night, he dreams of cutting entitlements. He dreams of refabricating Social Security and privatizing it. He doesn't dream of using the bargaining power of Medicare to negotiate better drug prices. Trump does, and in many ways, some of Trump's ideas seem like a rejection of the Tea Partification of the Republican parties. In other ways, he seems exactly like the culmination of it.
Well, I mean, I think that it's all right to say that he's open to some ideas that are good, but the matters on which he has been outspoken are horrendous. Just the idea of his negativism toward blacks, toward Hispanics, toward women. I mean, I go down the checklist, sure, of groups in the United States. By the time you're through with who he hates, you know, there's probably nobody left. I cannot accept the fact that somebody of his ilk, he's a bigot, mm-hmm. Can be the leader of the greatest nation in the world. I mean, the United States was built on broadening the ranks and the opportunities for all people. I don't get that message from Donald Trump. I had a run-in with this guy when I was governor of Connecticut. He wanted to build a casino in Connecticut, and I said, you can't, because that right belongs to the Mashantucket Pequot Indians. And he said, well, they're not Indians. I said, well, why aren't they? Why is that so? And he said, because they're black. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, was a historical matter where the disenfranchised Indians intermarried with the disenfranchised blacks, Negroes in Connecticut. So, yes, they are black, but it doesn't make any difference. And so I called him a bigot for that reason, and he got pretty exercised about it. But this, it only shows that 20 years ago he was the same guy that he is now. He could try to moderate himself into the center as he comes close to the nomination. But the real Donald Trump has been out there for a long time.
I don't disagree with you about any of that. But I do wonder what this insurgency is all about, because obviously with no voters, no followers, then there's no leader, there's no Trump. And it seems to me that a lot of the people who are backing Trump right now, if you listed 10 of his positions, they'd probably agree with five of them and maybe even violently disagree with the other five. And I wonder if the insurgency itself isn't just an attack on elites, on establishments. You know, I mean, not to compare Trump to Teddy Roosevelt, because they're nothing alike, but, you know, in 1912, there was an argument going on about who controls this party, the elites or the people. And I see a little of that going on right now.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think the Republican Party itself has lost its way, so that a man like Trump can come along and appeal to those that have been forgotten. And that's the problem. I don't deny the fact that both parties have sort of distanced themselves from the reality that is America. And whether it's the more conservative view of the Republicans, more liberal view of the Democrats, they're not paying attention to people's needs. I agree with that. But what I can't agree with is to have a demagogue come along and spout some words which he never believed in and doesn't believe in now in order to gain high public office.
We're talking to Lowell Weicker, former U.S. Senator and former governor of Connecticut. So let's game this out a little bit. All right. Let's imagine, as is still the probability, polls notwithstanding, that Trump loses this election because, as you've said, he's polarized himself. He's put himself on the other side of the fence from so many demographic constituencies. It's hard to imagine him winning a national election. So let's say that he loses and you've got 4 years, presumably, of President Hillary Clinton. What are the Republicans do either during or after those 4 years? Is the party just in splinters, or do they put it all together and maybe run a Paul Ryan 4 years later?
Yeah, I think that's what they have to do. I mean, I don't expect to see a liberal Jack Javits or Lowell Weicker or Clifford Case, you know, be the type of candidate the Republicans are going to gravitate to. They're going to gravitate to a conservative candidate, and I have no problem with that. I suspect the candidate will definitely be right of center. And certainly in Ryan, you have that man, and you also have a man with a great deal of experience. But what has to happen, you have to have the contention with Ryan that fashions compromise so that you have something a little less than a far-right solution. Now we get to my friends in the Democratic Party. I mean, they've lost it also. Hillary Clinton is totally disingenuous. Bernie Sanders, with his judging of his own party and his rhetoric, is splintering it. So there's nothing much to choose from on the Democratic side. And I think you've seen the latest polls. People are shocked that Hillary Clinton has lost her wide margin over Trump, mm-hmm. and is equal with him and a couple of polls behind him. It's because the Democrats do not offer a choice. We can mirror this national situation right here in Connecticut. Here we are, used to be one of the wealthiest states in the Union, splintered apart, deficit upon deficit upon deficit, tax raise after tax raise, and all because the Republicans do not have any office in the state of Connecticut, not in the state Senate, not in the state House, not in the governorship. So there is no contention that fashions the types of compromises that we used to have when I was in the state legislature and Democrats and Republicans shared the responsibility of Connecticut's government. So until that happens, you're not going to have great action on the national scene. You've got to have a Republican Party that contend with the Democrats or vice versa and that have to fashion compromises. That's why I'm not afraid of a Paul Ryan or anybody on the conservative side. I also want to see the Democrats come up with candidates that, you know, can perform. It's too bad Joe Biden's not running. He certainly would have been that kind of candidate.
It does seem that on the Democratic side, we're seeing a different kind of dying scream. And I do feel as though we probably won't see a nominee like Hillary Clinton, particularly if she were to lose this election, which is, you know, certainly possible, as you say. The polls are very close. If she were to lose, I don't think you'll see a candidate like her. And what I wonder, since you in your memories and in your writing go back to Barry Goldwater, I sometimes think of Bernie Sanders as the Barry Goldwater of the left. You know, he's got very strong positions, but in a way he ultimately can't make them palatable himself. He kind of needs, you know, kind of Reagan came along and put a happier face on some of Goldwater's ideas. And I do wonder if that's what will happen to the Democratic Party. They'll run a candidate 4 or 8 years from now who's a lot like Bernie Sanders, but a little bit more of a politician, a little bit more of a salesperson.
Yeah, well, don't forget, I knew Barry Goldwater very well. Right up until the end of his days. He lived in Phoenix, Arizona, where my sister lived, so I got to see a lot of him. And at the end of his life, you would categorize him as a moderate Republican, not the far right that sought the presidency. Mm-hmm. Over the years, Barry Goldwater gradually moderated his position. As a matter of fact, many of them on constitutional amendments, he joined with me in the United States Senate. So that has to happen. You went through that period where McGovern wrecked the Democratic Party, as much as I like George McGovern, nice man. And you're going through a period now where Republicans are also destroying their own party. I think sooner or later, they're going to start talking to each other. Don't forget, we are the ones that ultimately suffer from this. Mm-hmm. They don't even talk to each other. The House and the Senate refused to talk to President Obama. Mm-hmm. What the hell kind of governing is that? Well, it isn't. That's the whole point. And our national government, whether it be Republicans or Democrats, have to go ahead and communicate and fashion the compromises that make government work. That will happen, I suspect, after this next election, because I think both sides are going to get told to take a walk.
Can you imagine a Trump presidency? I mean, can you imagine how that play? Do you picture him being impeached in his second year? Or, well, I mean, what do you think would happen?
Well, we would no longer be the greatest nation on earth. I mean, the man doesn't have the basic knowledge in foreign policy or domestic to guide the United States of America. You know, I get back now to the main point, which I've made with many of my friends. As long as the United States of America does not vote, we're going to get idiots out there for our candidates. And right now, the voting in a presidential election is about 52% of the population. And probably for a United States senator, it's in the 40s, and for a congressman, in the 30s. So you do not get the best of America. You get every one-issue candidate or somebody that has a lot of money. And that's it. That should not be the United States of America.
You know, Governor, one thing that I've been thinking lately watching Connecticut is that, you know, as you say, the Republicans have not won an election in Connecticut, even at the congressional level. I think 2006 would have been the last time they won a congressional district or a governor's race. Since then, it's been all losses. But I do feel in 2018, if they run the right candidate, given the level of disenchantment that there is right now with the chaos at the General Assembly and the inability to get our fiscal house in order, I could see a Republican governor in 2018. What's your thinking about that?
Oh, I think it can happen, but I think there has to also be a change of attitude by the state of Connecticut. Mm-hmm. They have to, in other words, moderate and attune themselves to the demographic, which is Connecticut. Connecticut is a blue-collar state in the main. Mm-hmm. You have pockets of wealth down in Greenwich and Darien. I ought to know. I came from that area, and that was very helpful. But until the Republicans are able to take the cities of the state, they're not going to win an election. I think it is possible to elect a Republican governor in 2018, but it's got to be somebody of a totally different mindset than most of the Republicans that are serving right now. I forgot what it was, but the old Republican chairman, Jerry Labriola, I got along with well, even though I wasn't a member of the party. We talked all the time, and I enjoyed his company and what he had to say. The new chairman just went off on me the other day. I can't remember what it was. I've never met the man. I don't know what he is, but he was criticizing me for something in a philosophical sense. Well, I think philosophy is great as long as it's a moderate philosophy. Anything to the extreme, and the Republicans don't win. So if they're prepared to go ahead and run candidates for the House and the Senate and for governor that are of a moderate nature, they can win elections in the state of Connecticut. I think, if I'm not mistaken, you can correct me, I think I was the last statewide Republican to win an election. I know I won the governorship as an independent, but all my other election wins were as a Republican. Mm-hmm. And I think the Republicans forget that as they go ahead and take pot shots at me, which is, I don't mind, but I'd like to see him win because I think we would all benefit of an equal contest between Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah, I hate ever to correct you, but there was this fellow Roland who won some statewide elections.
Yeah, you're right.
And then a lady named Jody Rell, she won in 2006 too. She won statewide.
I don't include felons in my summary. Jody Rell's a lovely lady, yeah. And she deserves great credit, and I wish her happiness. And I gather she's going to Florida for the now.
Right, exactly. So I'm going to let you go here, although I'm sure you and I will be talking over the summer. I'll give you one last thing to chew on, though. When you look at the way the primary went in Connecticut, the Republican primary, Trump's strength to an astonishing degree ran right down the Naugatuck River or right down Route 8. And in those towns, I'm talking about Waterbury, Naugatuck, and then all those little towns down through the Naugatuck Valley, he was doing 70% wins, not 55, not 70% wins. So it goes to your point that Connecticut is in many ways a blue-collar state where to whatever degree Trump is resonating with a kind of blue-collar voter. Boy, you can see it right there just in the numbers down that spinal column.
Well, I'll tell you, that is a very important demographic and one to keep in mind. But I think my main message to your listeners, whether they're Republican or Democrat, you better get on the field and get your jerseys dirty in this business called politics. In other words, scrap it out. You can't enjoy what we've got by sitting in the stands and waving flags and cheering.
All right. Great message from Lowell Weicker, former U.S. Senator, former governor, getting ready for a lovely summer here in Connecticut. When we come back, has some offhanded remark that somebody made to you, has it just festered in your breast for decades? Now it's time to tell Henry Alford what that was.
We live in a political world. Courage is a thing of the past. The houses are haunted, children are unwanted. Your next day could be your last. We live in a political world. The one we can see and feel.
So, if you've ever seen the David Mamet play American Buffalo, you perhaps remember it begins with the character Teach, who's the protagonist of the play. He's a surly, thin-skinned, petty criminal. And he comes storming into this shop where his two friends are, and he's strangled with rage. He's so profane and so out of his mind with anger that it's almost difficult to figure out what has triggered this incident. But gradually we realize that he's been across the street in the diner where they all hang out. And he's taken a piece of toast off of the plate of a woman he knows very well, another one of their confederates whose name is Ruthie. And Ruthie has, in a certain tone of voice, said, "Oh, help yourself." And that has set Teach off. I think that might qualify as the kind of offhand remark, maybe not as lingering and festering as some, but the kind of offhand remark that our next guest, our frequent guest, Henry Alford, whenever we need to talk to people about modern manners, we get Henry Alford to do it for us. He's a journalist, humorist, and author of several books, including Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? A Modern Guide to Manners. And in the New York Times, he has written recently about this problem, the problem of the offhand insult. So, Henry, set this up for us. Give us a sense of what we're not talking about somebody who's directly in your face insulting you.
No, probably not. Probably this is a sort of unintentional swipe. And very often it comes from someone who you really enjoy spending time with, who you really value. And then all of a sudden, 20 hours after your last conversation, you're suddenly you can't let go of that that reference that she made to your quote-unquote bi-curious haircut.
I was polling people about this on Facebook, and a person who's a regular panelist on this show said that she had a college boyfriend who, and I think this is a part of it too, the person often thinks that they're maybe even complimenting you. So her college boyfriend said to her, you're very beautiful despite having a big nose.
It's true. Or a friend of mine, she was very surprised when she looked at her yearbook to see that someone had written, whatever you may look like on the outside, your charisma always shines through.
Oh, that's really horrible. And I think part of it also is it usually touches not a nerve of something that we've always worried about or suspected about ourselves. It often touches upon something we've never given a moment. For example, the woman I'm talking about had never before thought of her nose as big. And then went another 20 years of dwelling on her big nose. I mean, it activates a whole sense, a whole set of concerns we didn't have before.
Exactly. Right. It's this, and then it just starts metastasizing.
By the way, if any of you need to get one of these things off your chest, either one that you've committed or one that you have received, you may call us right now. We're live in the afternoon at 860-275-7266. You can say afterwards, you had a chance to talk about this with Henry Alford. How many people get that chance? 860-275-7266. You may also tweet us online at WNPRColin. So, Henry, one of the things that I was thinking about, first of all, I think we would both have to admit that we've probably done this ourselves to other people because the unintentionality of this is a lot of what goes with it.
Oh, absolutely. No, yeah, usually these are unwitting comments.
And so I was even thinking about the word actually.
I know, between actually and literally, adverbs have taken such a beating.
Yeah. Well, I had an incident. I could probably even say the actual names of the two people. So they're regular guests on this show. So I was sitting with Bill Curry and with Steve Metcalf, and we were listening to a piece of music. And Bill Curry made an observation about the piece of music. I can't remember what the observation was. And Steve turned to him and said, actually, Bill, that's a good point.
To the contrary, Bill. Yeah, that's actually is a really tricky one. But I think it brings up this interesting point that because it is a lighter offense as compared with some of these other ones, what you find is that the more open to interpretation the comment, the more revelatory of the person who feels maligned. So if someone does actually to you and you're pissed off, I think that tells me more about you than about the person who said actually.
Well, I think also, you know, and I think as you encapsulate wonderfully in your piece, the problem with this, the thing that makes it much more difficult, I mean, if a person attacks you frontally, you know, if someone says to me, look, you're an idiot and your show is terrible and I can't stand you. I mean, I don't know. That's I'm pretty much done with that after 30 minutes or 15 minutes or whatever. I mean, what can you do about that? I mean, this is just somebody who doesn't like you. And then there are going to be people who don't like you if you go through life thinking that there aren't. You're either Justin Bieber or a crazy person. I mean, we're assuming that there's a difference. You know, people are going to dislike you. Whereas this is, because as you're saying, some of the malignancy of this, some of the half-life of it is that you can't quite really establish, you know, what it was. It didn't feel like somebody trying to hurt you, but it hurt.
Yeah, precisely. And unlike a fight, there's no catharsis. That it is, just this kind of little found treasure that you're going to have to pick at and pick at until you deem its worth.
And by the way, yes, if anybody needs to get one off your chest, and I realize this would probably be a hard thing to talk about on the radio, but our number is 860-275-7266. Now, Henry Alford, I think the other thing is that it's sometimes what it really reveals, it lays bare two different sets of understandings about a single situation. And I did think of one where this happened to me. I was commenting, actually, in print, so there was no way to get away from it either. I was commenting, I was referring to this this marching band, this musical group that appears around this city. They're called the Hartford Hot Several, and I referred to them as a semi-ironic marching band. And on Facebook, I was sort of treated to the spectacle of their leader puzzling over this remark. He apparently doesn't think of it as a semi-ironic marching band. He thinks of it as a musical ensemble. And so right there, you know, we've revealed two different sets of understandings. I thought I was joining with him in celebrating the ironicness of all this.
Yeah. No, I think that's one of the two big groups of these comments is there's one that's a misperception of you. So something like what you just cited, or if someone says to you, oh, you liked that movie? Really? Because that, you know, that makes you, what you're hearing there is, you know, you have bad taste. And then the second big category are, the comments that validate something that you secretly feared about yourself.
The comments that you, and sometimes also, I mean, mostly the things that we're talking about, these offhand slights, are as we say, not intended to be hurtful. Although sometimes I think the other category, I don't know if I have a good example of this that comes to hand, is a person revealing how little they've thought of you all along and that they have... and they have probably been kind of concealing their contempt for you, but somehow or other it slipped out in the syntax of what they're saying.
Right. Well, this sort of brings to mind I spoke with a woman who was the first African-American woman to be on both North and South Poles. And during one of her treks, someone walked up to her and said, what hotel did you stay at on the North Pole? And that's the kind of comment, that betrays a total ignorance and perhaps a disinterest in the person he's talking to.
We have actually somebody looking for a counseling here with Henry Alford. Henry Alford, an expert on modern manners and mores and the author of Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? A Modern Guide to Manners. Sales of this book invariably skyrocket when he appears on our show, so make sure you leave immediately after you hear the show and go get this book. But here's Brett in Newington. Brett, I think you might need to turn your radio down. I think I feel as though I hear the radio in the background. Then there you go. So otherwise you'll be in a terrible time warp. So do you have a question or an observation?
An apology to to no one who will chance upon this. I spice my conversation daily with wit and sarcasm, and I was overhearing someone talk about someone else. I used to race motorcycles, talking about another racer who, and they said, oh, he races well. And I just, under my breath, loud enough for them to hear, I said, well, he races. And, that's a little crass from a, multi-regional national champion. But it was with friends, it was with associates, and it was kind of sort of just joking around, but it was, I apologize.
Well, I think, first of all, it's good that you're apologizing. Are you a multi-regional national champion, or is he a multi-regional national champion?
I am.
You are. Well,
which makes me a bigger beep.
Yeah, I think I don't mean to speak for Henry Alford, who may have his own deep thoughts about this. Henry being as immersed in the competitive motorcycle world as he is, but I feel as though with great power comes great responsibility, Brad. And you, as a multi-regional national motorcycling champion, it befits you, or perhaps it behooves you to wear the crown of greatness. With more, charm and affection.
Yes,
well, Tom
I agree.
Kiffin, national champion, had once told me that the best thing to say on the podium is boost up the second and third place because the better they look, you beat them.
Right.
The better you look.
Yeah.
Not, it was easy, I had no problems, it was just a ride in the park. No, that's wrong.
All right, salute your competitors. All right, Henry, this is your chance to instruct somebody. And as I say, you take a backseat to nobody in your expertise about the competitive motorcycling world, and most motorcycles don't have backseats anyway.
True. And, I think with your multi-regional national motorcycle champions, that no one is expecting you to weigh in on other people's prowess at that sport. I think, what we expect from that person is a steely look of determination. So I think that, you know, in the future, if Brett is the recipient of any of these kind of comments, yeah, I think just grit the lips, you know, make sure the hair is very tousled, and I think the moment will pass.
One of the things that you found out is even people who are in communion with divinity are not immune from the slings and arrows of this offhand remark. Wasn't there a pastor who was haunted by what would seem to be actually a neutral remark? Oh, that was interesting? Was that the remark?
Yeah, right. So Father Frank Desiderio, who is a preacher, told me that, yeah, when people are spilling out of the chapel and all saying, oh, good homily, Father, thank you, Father, that the comment that always sticks in his craw is the person who says, that was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so,
yeah.
Exactly. Even the berobed and the professionally wise are not immune from this stuff.
But some of that I feel is regional. You know, I had a friend who left a job in private education here on the East Coast, have worked in a couple of East Coast milieus, and moved to a very prestigious school in Minneapolis or the greater Minneapolis area. And he would note that, you know, you'd go to see something, say a piece of drama that was very challenging, you know, and that might stir up very profound emotions, either of admiration or contempt or disturbance. And that walking out of that with a bunch of Midwesterners, he would hear people going, well, that was different.
Yeah.
That was different.
Exactly. It's that it's open to interpretation. It's the same with the person who, in that same theater setting, you know, the person who rushes up to a performer and says, that was so brave. Mm. That's either the loveliest thing that performer has heard or the most damning.
It's a long story, but I walked off stage one time with having performed kind of accidentally with a very well-known singer, Marie McGovern, who, as we walked off stage, turned to me and said, not a great key for you, was that?
There's no morning after for you.
There was very good, nice catch with that cultural reference. So Henry Alford, as we begin to wrap things up here, I feel like we need to leave people with something. You know, I mean, and I found reading your article to be anxiety provoking because I thought, well, I mean, you know, I've been just running my mouth here on planet Earth for decades. I'm sure I've done this. I'm sure that I've deeply. I had to come in here and ask producer Betsy Kaplan, did I ever wound you with one of my offhand remarks? I mean, setting aside the fact that I make fun of you all day long, have I ever accidentally wounded you with an offhand remark? And I think, you know, maybe we just have to give everybody amnesty for what you've done so far.
Totally. I am so tickled and thrilled that was your reaction to the article. That's what I hope is happening across the nation.
Just a sense of general forgiveness and an awareness that stuff happens, right?
Exactly. And I mean, to speak, you know, not ironically, no, I think if there's a suspicion in your mind that you may have said something like that, people will love it if you bring it up and say, hey, was I out of line here? And they'll let you know.
They will let you know. All right, Henry Alford, the best manners that anybody could show would be to immediately buy or order a copy of Would It Kill You to Stop Doing That? A Guide to Modern Manners. That's Henry's book. Thanks for being with us again.
Thank you so much,
all right,
Colin.
In case of manners emergency, we will break glass and get you back out again. We're going to take a little break right now, and we'll come back with a conversation about the complexion of sports managers, and I do mean that in multiple senses. All right, we've come to the moment in the program where ordinarily Kion Wolf says the credits, so I will do that now. First of all, Kion Wolf is off today. That means Betsy Kaplan's running the board in addition to producing the entire show. Jonathan McNichol is in there assisting her right now, and Josh Nalea is manning the phones because we also have no interns right now. So everybody's doing a lot of things, and somebody, of course, is playing the part of Bill Curry. I think it's probably Dusty Baker. And obviously we have a wonderful website at WNPR.org where you can get a show page with all the audio from today and photographs and stuff, but also lots of work by our wonderful news department and all of our archive shows. And so go to WNPR.org. Tomorrow, well, you will hear a show. We actually recorded it last week, but it will feel live to you. We are live from the Great Hall of Dinosaurs in the Peabody Museum in New Haven. We will be surrounded by dinosaurs, talking about dinosaurs with people who know dinosaurs best. So what could be better than that? So join us for that at our regular time. And you will hear Kion Wolf on that show, too. All right. So, and thanks, by the way, to Greg Hill, who handles our Twitter feed at WNPRColin. So for our final segment, we wanted to talk about something that had kind of escaped my attention. I do follow baseball, but I'm mostly concerned with the fortunes of the Boston Red Sox. And I had sort of failed to notice that, in fact, the Atlanta Braves, in getting rid of their manager early in the season here, had eliminated the last Hispanic or Latino manager in baseball right now. I would add to that that I think there are only two African-American managers at this point, Dave Roberts and Dusty Baker. Maybe I'm missing somebody. But joining us to talk about all this is Mina Kimes, senior writer and columnist at ESPN the magazine. First of all, welcome. And second of all, am I saying your name correctly?
You said it perfectly.
Oh, good. So let's first of all talk about this issue of Latino managers. Obviously, the workforce that is managed by managers in baseball is heavily Latino. How heavily Latino is it?
As of the last count, so on opening day, it was about 30%. And obviously, there's zero managers. And you were correct in saying there's only two non-white managers in all of baseball right now.
And so one of the things that you've looked at and talked about is, are there any candidates? Well, it would seem, first of all, with a 30% Latino workforce playing baseball, that there would be a lot of candidates. And there are a lot of candidates. And they're, for some reason or another, not getting the offers. Do you get a sense from them as to why they feel that that's not happening?
I think that's the big question, right? I mean, There are candidates, Sandy Alomar, Manny Acta, who's the Mariners now, Joey Cora. And Cora, you know, as a former player, gave a great interview to ESPN late last week where he talked about the lack of opportunities and was trying to puzzle through why none of these candidates are able to break through or why it's happening so intermittently. And he's interviewed for many jobs and has talked about sort of feeling like those interviews might have been sort of just for the face of it and not actually real interviews with real opportunities.
Right. He actually parsed that a little bit more finely. We should, first of all, say that Joey Cora has been managing off and on in the minor leagues since, I think, like 2003. So it's not as though he hasn't done this kind of work or paid the kind of dues that major league managers often pay. But he talked about how there's kind of a Selig rule, which is that that major league clubs, when they look for a manager, need to at least consider Latino or minority candidates, and that he felt in some cases as though a box were being checked, that in talking to him, they were satisfying that requirement of having talked to somebody.
Yeah, he talked about doing an interview where they didn't even know that he had gone to Vanderbilt, which led him to believe that they hadn't looked into him at all and weren't seriously considering him as a candidate. You got to think, if you're interviewing with somewhere, they might at least have some familiarity of your background, right? And the Selig rule, and you hit on something really important there, which is it actually only says that teams have to consider candidates. It doesn't say, like the Rooney rule in the NFL, that they have to interview them. So there are a lot of situations in baseball where it's unclear whether these candidates are even coming through the door. You know, last year in Miami, they hired an insider as a manager, and there were a lot of questions over whether they had actually taken a serious look at any minority candidates.
You know, we're talking to Mina Kimes from ESPN, the magazine. So there are a lot of questions here that are unanswerable unless somebody decides to be like a whistleblower from inside Major League Baseball. Yeah. We'll never know the answer to a lot of these questions. But we should even observe that there was a moment in, I think, late October carrying forward into the winter where Major League Baseball had no managers of color. They had fired a whole bunch of them in the offseason, and neither Baker nor Roberts had been hired by their respective teams, Washington and the Dodgers. So there weren't any managers of color. And you have to think, Mina, that this seems counterproductive also at the level of baseball needing to keep a diversified audience, needing to have teams that look like the rest of America and relate to the rest of America.
Absolutely. The sport has major demographic concerns about, you know, getting too old and too white and its fan base. And also, you'd think that with so many of the players speaking Spanish, it would be a huge advantage, right, to have a manager who can speak Spanish. And this isn't just a problem, I think, with managers. It's also with GMs and presidents. I think there's only four non-white GMs. And Cora brought this up in his interview. He was saying, you know, maybe we need to start focusing on that side so the guys who are actually hiring these managers aren't all white.
So I have to say that, yeah, you called our attention to the Cora article on the ESPN website. So I, God help me, I looked at the comment thread, and it looked like a Trump rally. I mean, the stuff that people were saying was kind of stomach-turning in its level of vituperation and dismissiveness of Cora's arguments. You know, that made me wonder. I mean, obviously, Major League Baseball doesn't make its decisions based on what trolls say on comment threads. But I wondered if the two were completely unyoked. And I guess what I'm saying is, you know, it may still be that the Major League front office thinks, well, you know, if we have Ryan Sandberg as our manager, you know, and he's kind of the face of the club to whatever extent a manager is the face of the club, you know, in terms of the constituency that we are courting right now and that we do try to connect with, given the fact that, if, you know, that the audience is still kind of white. I mean, it may just be that. It may be, you know, we can just sell more tickets with Ryan Sandberg as our manager.
I think what's happening in baseball and football, right, and all major sports, is something that happens in corporate America, where minorities are also underrepresented on boards and in the executive suite. It's not unique to sports. Some of it is just a legacy of discrimination, but all of it, a lot of it, I think, also is just networks. You know, a lot of these people hire their friends. They network their, you know, the whole good old boy thing, I think, still happens. So a lot of it might not be deliberate or intentional, but unless there are checks in place to ensure that these candidates are actually considered, you do end up leaning on the same old faces for these jobs.
And, you know, when we have these conversations, too, it brings up an area of discomfort. Like, I don't have anything against Brian Price, who's the manager of the Cincinnati Reds, and it's probably not his fault that they're a terrible team. They are kind of terrible, and they're dead last. I mean, he's in his third season with nothing to show for it. They, in fact, fired Dusty Baker, whose record was way better with the Reds, and now has the Nationals playing over 600, to get to Brian Price. But you sort of wonder, you know, in terms of that network and in terms of the way things are understood, I mean, he's been the manager since 2014. You wonder whether their patience goes a little bit further for him than, say, the Braves did with the manager they fired.
This was a question that came up last year in football with Lovie Smith in Tampa Bay, you know, where he was, I think a lot of people were surprised when he was let go quickly after making some improvements. And you know, we don't know, right? They're not going to say, nobody's going to come out and say it. I think you can draw inferences. But last year I did a column on the Rooney Rule and why there were so few African-American coaches and GMs in the NFL. And some scientists had looked at the promotions of candidates and found that at the lower levels, minority coaches took longer to become coordinators than white coaches, even with the same background, experience, success level, all variables held constant. So when you actually look at this from a rigorous analytical standpoint, I think you do see that maybe the discrimination is not outright, but it certainly exists.
One of the other things we know is that the press, the sports press, is also kind of white, right?
Absolutely. It extraordinarily underrepresented minority-wise for both non-white and women.
One of the things that you wrote about, you've written about previously, too, is the role of women in Major League Baseball. There, I have to say, one of the joys for me of this year has been having a woman in the booth for a national Major League Baseball broadcast on Monday nights. And she's terrific, and I really like her, and I think she adds a ton. And I'm thinking, why? I know the Yankees have had somebody for quite a while. But, I mean, there's so many jobs in Major League Baseball that you would think that women would be heavily recruited for. This is something you've looked at. What did you find?
So I looked at this actually in the wake of the Ray Rice issue and some of the NFL's, you know, public relations problems, expecting baseball to be better in terms of representation, diversity. And what I actually found was that the NFL had taken great steps to recruit women and promote them to higher ranking roles. And in MLB, it had actually gotten worse over the last few years. The central office staff, the percent of women has declined. Only 18% of vice presidents on the teams are women, and that hasn't gotten better in years. You know, you would expect to see some improvement there, but there really wasn't.
One would expect to see that, and would expect to see that maybe even in the ranks of umpires. Is it just too big a culture to overturn? Before I ask you that question, another thing that we could say about all this is it doesn't start in the major leagues. It's all over the place. And certainly even in the college ranks, top ranking college baseball programs do not have managers of color. I mean, they're even worse at it, I think, than the major leagues are. So is there just a pervasiveness about this culture, and it's so finely grained that you can't get change?
You know, with sports, the argument you always hear is, well, they didn't play, which is ridiculous. I mean, especially in baseball, where so many analytics-driven GMs who definitely didn't play and are not athletes have been successful. So you ask, why can't women as well? And we're not talking even about entirely baseball roles, right? When I say vice presidents, I mean community relations and marketing and all of that stuff. So there's no reason why, other than possibly a smaller candidate pool, it's inexplicable, and I do think that the league has shown signs of trying to fix it, but it is an uphill battle.
Once again, it does seem as though you want your face to look like the faces of the people that whose approval you're trying to court. And so one of the ways in which professional sports grow and have grown is by attracting a female audience. So, I mean, that's why Jessica Mendoza seems like such a great idea, you know, to hear a woman's voice on a national telecast just seems like a no-brainer.
Absolutely. You always hear about growing in other countries and trying to find untapped markets. Well, there's an enormous untapped market in the United States, and it's 50% of the country. So, you know, why wouldn't these teams in all of these sports be doing everything they can to try to court that from a business perspective, I think is a little incomprehensible.
I'll tell you, as reading your stuff and reading some of the stuff that you recommended that we read, my one final insight about this, it's a fairly depressing one, but if you want to find minorities on the coaching staffs of Major League Baseball teams, you look at a lot of other kinds of jobs. And in particular, there's like almost a trope of the black batting coach. You know, you look at the National League teams, there's a lot of African-American batting coaches. And to me, there's something a little disturbing about that. It's kind of like, oh, yeah, we trust you to teach people how to do what you did very well. We don't trust you to think more comprehensively about stuff or manage strategies or work with people and work with a sort of cohesive plan for implementing the talents of 25 or so players. We just trust you to talk about the thing that you used to do so well.
Yeah, and that's a problem in football as well, where there's a real absence of black quarterback coaches, for example, which tend to be the positions that get promoted to become offensive coordinators, which then go on to become coaches. So there is a sense of, I think, compartmentalization going on that trickles upwards.
Which is not to say that I would look forward to the idea of Barry Bonds as a major league manager. He is a batting coach right now. I think that's probably maybe the limit of what he has to offer in that particular regard. But there's lots of other people who could offer so much more. Mina Kimes, this is fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is Mina Kimes, senior writer and columnist at ESPN, the magazine. As we're heading out here, I'll mention a few other things coming up this week. I've already told you that we will have our show from the Peabody. We're really excited about this show. If you haven't been keeping up with dinosaurs, Well, I'll just say you haven't been keeping up with dinosaurs. Almost by definition, you haven't. But anyway, we'll be telling you stuff about dinosaurs that you just didn't know or didn't realize, and also telling you a little bit about the nature of this particular museum. It's a museum with a pretty amazing history, and we certainly will have people who know about as much about dinosaurs as anybody is ever going to know as our guests. And on Wednesday, we'll be talking to Buzz Aldrin live on the air. You could actually call in and say something to Buzz Aldrin. Buzz Aldrin, I don't know, he excites people in a certain way. We're not 100% sure on Thursday. We think it's going to be a show about the concept of hydration. How's that for a diverse lineup? And then on Friday, it'll be The Nose. We are actually talking on The Nose about Maria Bamford's new Netflix series. You might want to watch a few episodes of that just to get ready. It's called Lady Dynamite. All right, that's all for today. Thanks to everybody who helped out. We'll talk to you tomorrow.